So cool. Yeah, I'm gonna get started, and yeah, I do like new technologies. I'm one of the fools that has like internet powered light bulbs and stuff, where if you like SCP enough data over your network, your lights stop responding, things like that. But I knew that going in, so that was fine. As was mentioned, I'm the founder of a company called HashiCorp. I'm actually not gonna talk too much about any of our tools. I'll mention them, but I'm going to try to mention them alongside tools that we also don't write. I'm not trying to pitch sort of our tools specifically in this talk. Just for like recognition purposes, if you recognize any of these tools, I'll just read out the names, but that's almost the last time I'll talk about most of these. So from top to bottom here, there's Vagrant, Packer, Surf, Consul, Terraform, Vault, Nomad, and then this last logo just represents our enterprise tooling. But all these tools are tools that I helped get started. I was at least sort of 50% of the lines of code for the 0.1. Many of these I'm not involved with on a day-to-day basis from a coding perspective anymore, but obviously I still work with all of them. So that's a little bit about me. Today what I want to talk about is more broadly sort of looking at the future of tools and techniques and ops as the way I see it. I sort of drown myself every day on a daily basis in what's happening and what's not happening. And so having that perspective, there's a lot of noise out there, and my intention is to try to add a little bit of signal to it of what you should be looking at if you just don't have time to also drown yourself in everything new that's happening. So to get started, I just want to define this concept that I usually define in most of the talks I give, which is what I call the modern data center, which is, data center is sort of becoming, to me, a pretty abstract word these days. And so I want to define what I view as the modern data center. And this is probably the only part in the talk where we'll talk at all kind of about history, and even then it's going to be like two slides, just because I know most of you here are probably familiar with it, and I'm not trying to give a history lesson at all. So I just mention it just to sort of paint the picture forward. So the trend with what I would call the modern data center is sort of a story of rising data center complexity, and complexity sort of measured in the way that there's a lot more moving parts and there's a lot more different parts. Historically, a data center was a physical thing. Like it wasn't very abstract at all. It was like a physical building that you could point at the servers and you could point at the racks, and it was a thing. It still is today, but the word's also used for the more abstract notion too. And as things grew, we got more servers, but more or less, there's still enough, historically where you could just manage them manually. That's probably the most time-efficient way to do it. Automation probably just, like, it's not worth the trade-off at that point. You could just sort of manually do things, add servers. Networking's easy, storage is fairly easy, so on. Very quickly thereafter, we start adding some layers of abstraction to that, the first primary one being virtualization. And I'm not going to add any sort of like, I don't add any dates to any of this because you adopt this at any given time. I remember reading like an analyst report last year that I think it was 2015 where they expected the Fortune 500 to complete their adoption of virtualization. Like I won't put dates on here because people are at different stages, but this is generally the trend going. And I'm also not trying to make the claim that this is the order things were necessarily invented in, because obviously everything in computer science was invented in the 70s, and we're just riding that wave still. So, anyways, virtualization comes along, and the primary thing here I'm trying to show is that there's more parts. There's now servers with VMs or servers without VMs. You now have to deal with the idea of sort of virtualized networks and storage and so on. It's getting a little more complicated to deal with. And at this sort of scale, starting to see the more general adoption of automation, configuration management, things like that as a means of managing this rising complexity. And then more recently, we've been slammed with containers on everything. So there's now containers everywhere, which is obviously another layer of abstraction. And interestingly enough, the most common way to deploy containers is on top of VMs today, even though it's not strictly necessary. That's probably due to just clouds, like clouds in general using VMs. But there's just more stuff, again, a trend. And then the last aspect of it, and this is where the word data center starts becoming a little more abstract, are these cloud services in general, represented by the clouds. But these are basically outsourced functionality that in the previous 2, 5, 10 years, you probably would have considered sort of core infrastructure technology. I know there's a number of sort of outsourced technologies that pretty much every company uses these days that I think 10 years ago, most system administrators would say, you know, like, over my dead body, am I not managing that in-house? And here they are. And then one of the last aspects is multi-data center. Multi-data center used to be, you know, a concept that was relegated to the people who had the money to afford it. And nowadays, pretty much anybody could just, like, click a button and have two servers in two different data centers. Obviously, you can't click a button and wave over all the complexity that comes with having multiple data centers, but it's really easy to do this. So startups, like if you're working with a small company, it's very common that they're just in multiple regions and things like that. And so this is coming up rather quickly. So it's just something you need to keep in mind. And so at the end, what it looks like is kind of like this, because it's not any single sort of set of technologies. It's usually a mixture of a bunch. Not usually all, unless you're looking at a very large, older company. But it's a mixture of kind of everything. Multi-data centers, some are in the cloud, some are not. Some are VMs, some are not, et cetera. There's all these as-a-services that exist, and for the most part, all of them are necessary in a common business. There's infrastructure as a service, which is very simply, you know, requesting infrastructure components like VMs or containers. There's platform as a service, which is sort of, you know, deploy my application and I don't do ops, so to speak, at least the aspiration there. And then there's SaaS, which is like DNS as a service, database as a service, load balancer as a service. And realistically, I don't see any real businesses these days without all three or heading in the direction of having all three of these. And then the final part is just operating systems. And this is probably the least complex. Every organization usually has a like 90%+ case of a single operating system, but almost everybody for some reason still has like that one sad like Windows machine in the corner running, you know, Active Directory or something, or Exchange or something. So there's still a little bit of heterogeneity there to think about. And so in the end you have this and you have those other choices, and this is sort of what we have to look at today. And the reason why this definition is important to me is because as a tool creator, as someone who's trying to create tools to help manage this complexity, the tools need to at least acknowledge the reality of pretty much anything in this picture. We need to have a story for multi-data center. We need to have a story for containers, for VMs, for not VMs, for cloud, for not cloud. And what I found is sort of from a consumer side too, you also need to be thinking about this, because some tools will force more things than others, and developers will push more things than others. And so being aware of what the trade-offs are of all these things is pretty important. But this looks really complicated, and one of the questions I get is why. And this is usually from the like get off my lawn type people. It's like, why did we do any of this? Everything was perfectly fine 20 years ago, and I had a great job, and now it's just chaos and disaster. And fire, and you know what comes to mind, like the flag of their like clan is usually like that dog sitting in the room with fire all around it. These are these people. But the why is basically just this one sentence. It's we're just trying to get better at delivering and maintaining applications. The needs, the sort of number of applications, the complexity of the applications were just so different even 5 years ago that we're just trying to help sort of keep up with that, and in doing so, things become more complicated. And I don't mention it in this talk. I've given another talk where I talk about how, like, as you try something new, it's horribly complicated because you just don't understand any of it. And over time, you sort of build tooling or prune off feature sets or something. And over time, it actually becomes quite easy. And I think a good example of that is virtualization. Like, virtualization used to be a pretty much inevitably very expensive thing and very hard thing to learn. And nowadays, like, you could just, like, for fun on a weekend, I've written, like, an x86, like, virtualization thing that could boot up toy OSs. It's, like, it's a very approachable technology these days, which I think is an amazing sign. Like, we're able to move forward. But I think a lot of the new stuff especially people that if you live in the industry and you see it right when it's brand new, it's really hard to understand and horribly complicated. But my optimism is that over 2 or 5 years, it becomes very approachable and very easy. And so one of the things like people often tell me is that, and it's totally fine if like you never use any of the software, right? That's okay. But some people tell me, oh, I've been meaning to adopt that for so long, but it's been like I've been saying that for 2 years and still haven't adopted your tools. And it's like awesome, because if you wait another year, it's going to be even easier to use. Like if you adopted it 2 years ago, you might be, sending me threats on Twitter. And if you adopt it now next year, you're suddenly like sending me flowers. It's a really interesting thing. So we have this complexity, and what I want to talk about is we've now been living in this world of what I defined as the modern data center for probably like 3 to 5 years. And in that time period, some best practices of techniques, tooling have been emerging as what's looking like the way to do things. And this isn't going to be a totally exhaustive set of things. I'm going to be leaving out some pretty critical things. Like I don't talk about monitoring at all, which is probably important. but I talk about the things. And the things that I talk about are obviously going to be biased to sort of like what I look at on a day-to-day basis at HashiCorp. But like I said, I try to bring in non-HashiCorp tools to balance it out. But that bias sort of makes sense because that's what I'm reading into every day and thinking about every day and analyzing every day. So I'm going to cover, I think, like 4 or 5 or maybe 6 different things that are coming together to build what I think the abstract for this talk included the phrase glorious future. And so I will paint that in the later on of what this looks like. And I fully expect that like some of these will be what's the word I'm looking for? Some of these will be you could argue either way. You could say that you could totally disagree with me, and I expect that. I try to back everything up with reason, a lot of reason. But yeah. So the first one I think is a lot of people argue about. So the first one is heterogeneity, and the idea with heterogeneity is that we're just gonna continue to have more differing technologies in use, and not less. And so, to define the opposite of this, the inverse of this, the idea with homogeneity is the dream or aspiration that despite all this growth, we'll be able to bring down the complexity by standardizing on sort of a single paradigm, like all virtualization or all containers, et cetera, or a single tech stack, or even a single cloud provider. And I don't disagree with the fact that that would be fantastic. That would, if we all agreed that we were only ever going to use a single tech stack or just containers or something, that focuses everybody's energy to make one thing way better. And that one thing would get way better. And so I don't disagree the value there. But in reality, sort of what I learned, I don't think this is going to happen at all in any of these categories. And so to sort of paint the reality as I see it, things are going to continue to change. And things generally change because somebody thinks it's going to make it better. I put the asterisk there because not all change is better. I think that all change has the goal or the aspiration by that person to make things better. It's very rare, it's pretty sad actually on like Hacker News or something when someone does like a show Hacker News and shows them their side project and people just like tear them out for like having the fact that this is like a totally solved problem in some way. But it's actually very rare for me to see somebody that tried to do something that actually knew that there was something better, and they were just trying to. I mean, it's more common that they knew what was out there, they built something because they thought they could do it better, and maybe they don't. I think the reasoning is pure, and so things keep changing for the better eventually. And so if you agree that like we're going to keep getting changed, that people aren't going to stop changing, it sort of like therefore leads to a couple choices. One is that if you believe in homogeneity, you're sort of saying that change will stop happening, or more likely, change will stop happening for us. We've chosen the thing that we think is perfect, and despite all the change happening, we're just going to stick with it because this thing is perfect. I don't think that most people think this. So then the other approach is that you're claiming that change could be atomic, that you've chosen the perfect stack, but then when the next perfect stack comes and you choose it, you're going to be able to completely atomically go from stack A to stack B, and you'll never have any middle ground. But the more reality is that change is gradual. B change to F? Yeah. The more reality is that change is gradual. And so realistically, you chose your perfect stack and you love it, and then some thing is coming along, and whether you want to or some developer, you know, some punk developer's forcing you to or whatever, you need to move to this future F. And so you start doing so, and usually the steps there is like A prime dot 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 to F. It's not atomic. And if you dig into that a little bit more and start looking at this, it's actually more, it's worse than this. Because you have this, but really the future you're moving to is like F1, and then while you're moving to F1, before you complete it, F2 happens, and so you start moving B to F2, and then F3 happens, and you have C to F3, and then you basically have these just multiple like complexity things happening, and then always again you have that sad server in the corner, which is just like D, which just never moves. And this is for any non-trivially sized organization, this is the reality. The only people I've ever seen that can move really quickly from A to B, it's still not atomic, but can move quickly enough that they can move from, I should use F, I guess, can move from A to F before F2 comes out, is usually like a startup with three servers. Anything more than that, and you have other real problems to approach and not enough people to actually dedicate the resources to fully making these switches. And so for that, you know, the way I look at it is that that arrow sign is heterogeneity. I would have said implied here, but implied is the arrow sign, so that would have been confusing. But the arrow sign to me is heterogeneity. And because of that, I've sort of completely embraced the idea that fighting against the change is going to cause more problems than just trying to build tooling to support the differences that could happen. As much as possible. So then let me explain the flip side. Let me explain what the benefits are and what I mean by accepting that the world will be heterogeneous. So the core idea, obviously, is to embrace that things are going to be different and things are going to change, and you won't have a single sort of stack in your company. And so the idea here is once you do that, you then could consciously sort of choose tooling that aligns with that reality. Obviously, if you believe in a homogeneous future, you choose tooling that aligns with that. If you believe that everything is going to be sort of like a Docker stack, for example, then you just have to pay Docker Inc. money, and you never have to pay anyone else money, and you could go down that path because you sort of have a belief. But on the flip side, if you believe in heterogeneity, then you should choose tooling that aligns with that reality. So choose tooling that either works with multiple paradigms or strives to work with multiple paradigms. You should also hire people that have that mentality. If you choose that this is the way you believe in things, hiring the people that will fight this is going to be damaging to your organization. So there's other companies that they'll find that they could they, that believe that everything will be the same. But last of all, basically, is in this future you don't suddenly give up and just adopt everything. You don't say, okay, since everything is going to be different anyway, I might as well just use everything at a whim. No, you still have to be mindful of change. You still have to think this through. And I think one of the better public examples here is sort of Google for a very long time. For a very long time, Google standardized on basically three stacks for the majority of their applications, which was C++, Java, and Python. There's every language is in Google somewhere, but for the majority of code, those were sort of the three blessed languages. And so they embraced heterogeneity, but said that it will be controlled to these three languages. And now it's sort of changing. There's like a lot more Go growing in there and stuff like that. But that's a mindful adoption of new technologies. It's saying we could be different because different tools are better for the job, but you can't just introduce anything you want. So there's basically three types of heterogeneity I talked about. One is multi-cloud, so I'll explain sort of why I believe that multi-cloud is an inevitable future, basically. So the motivation for it, one of them is region availability. All clouds are not made equal in terms of where their data center, their physical data centers exist. And this motivates different organizations to adopt different clouds. So if you really need a data center in the middle of China, then you're going to probably have a different cloud provider than Amazon, because Amazon has, I think, one or two Chinese regions, but there are cloud providers that have a lot of Chinese regions. On the same topic of regions is usually law. There's a lot of countries that must, adopt a cloud provider that's based in that country, or maybe even incorporated in that country, and so that helps shift the decision making to one or another. Then there's feature sets. So for the most part, the base sort of compute, storage, networking is more or less sort of becoming a commodity really, really quickly in the cloud environments. You could get that for anything. That's sort of like a necessary step zero for any of these cloud providers. But as they start building sort of higher level features, they're differentiating quite a bit. There's certain clouds focusing more than others on things like machine learning or big data analytics, or so on. So these feature differences actually are a huge driving factor, because sometimes a feature gives a disproportionate advantage to your company's business interests, so that cloud actually becomes more interesting to you. Next is pricing. Pricing is straightforward, but also probably the most artificial of all three of these, because these cloud companies are actually able to use pricing as a leverage point. I guess I won't name any just because I don't know, but I don't know if it's even true, because it's usually leaked information. But pricing, a good example is that I know for sure that like cloud providers are offering very large companies ridiculously low rates that are probably at a loss just to get them onto the cloud platform. Because the idea is that once you're on a cloud platform, it's very sticky and it's very hard to move, so you probably won't. So there are really crazy sort of like 5-year deals out there to move millions of dollars worth of compute and storage and networking onto these different cloud providers. So that's motivating. On a more realistic standpoint, we have a customer that uses Amazon for sort of all their compute needs. For whatever reason, it's price efficient to use Amazon for compute, but they actually use Google Cloud for all their big data processing stuff for primarily pricing, actually. I think they do like the features better on Google Cloud, but primarily pricing. So they use multiple clouds for that reason. The next one is lock-in avoidance, and this is happening pretty quickly. We had a customer we've been working with for a couple of years come to us this year, and they had sort of a tiger team internally that was the driving, and this is a Fortune 500, it's sort of like a driving force between their transition from physical data centers to AWS. And they've done that over the past few years, and they're like greater than 90% on AWS now, and the path to finish the last 10% is quite clear. So that tiger team sort of leaving that team, but now they're working with us again to come up with the entire plan for them to move to Azure. And the reason is not because they actually intend to twice in 5 years move their entire production workloads to another cloud. The reason is actually so that next year they could go to Amazon and sort of extort them in a way. They could say like, "Oh, I see, you're not giving us this awesome 5-year deal anymore. Well, Azure is, and we already have the plan in place to move in less than a month, and so this huge contract will just move." And so we're helping them do that, and that's sort of a lock-in avoidance type thing to avoid price gouging in a way. And then there's multi-tech. So that's multi-cloud, and the reason why multi-cloud inevitably will just become a thing. The multi-tech motivation is pretty straightforward, so I won't spend a lot of time on this. It's the right tool for the job. And by tech, I mean like language or full stack or framework or however you want to break that down. But there's better tools for certain jobs, obviously. So there's that. There's also job markets. These change quite a bit. Like, for example, a number of decades ago, COBOL was probably the right choice. You made the right choice if you chose that language. Today, it's probably not, just because you have to pay those people, in like children, basically. They're so expensive. So you could still get a job, you could still hire COBOL people, but probably for the value you're getting out of it, it's not worth it for your entire organization to be on that language. And so you had to shift to something like Java. And that's like sort of a multi-decade example. But there's a lot smaller examples too of just, this is why Google chose C++, Java, and Python, is because they all solved different, they could all they're all Turing complete. They could all solve the same problems, but they do certain problems much better. And so you have these different things. And so that's a motivating factor. And then the last one is forced requirements, which is usually people like Apple or Microsoft saying, like, well, this has to be Swift or .NET or something. And they're getting, well, Microsoft for sure is getting better about that. But that's a smaller issue. The top two are usually the primary motivators. And then the last one is multi-compute. I didn't know what to call this. I don't think compute's the right word. But what I mean here is just basically VMs versus containers versus just physical hardware. And the motivation here is generally, again, right tool for the job sort of, or requirements. There might be performance requirements that you just really want to run that on a physical machine. There might be legacy requirements where for whatever reason it just doesn't behave right in a container and you're not going to rewrite it, so you have to not run it in a container. There's security requirements, like for example for our Vault software, Vault runs perfectly well in a container. We still recommend that you run it in a VM just because there's a longer history of sort of known security analysis of virtualization. It's not that we doubt that containerization could get there, it's just that if you're running like a security server, why take the risk? Like just throw it in a VM for now and figure that out later. There's also a big existing knowledge or experience thing. Another company we're working with is like, and this goes with heterogeneity. I should have talked about this with heterogeneity. Actually based in Boston. I was in Boston and visiting this probably once Fortune 500. I think they're falling out. But I visited this company and they're very forward thinking. They're moving everything to the cloud. They're moving everything to containers. They're doing all this stuff. But then I was with the, like, I don't know, VP of infrastructure or CIO or something, and he, like, walked to the window, and he's like, do you see that building over there? And I was like, yep, what's that building? And he said, well, that's X, this web property that everyone in this room would know. He's like, that's X. We haven't shipped a new feature in 15 years. It makes $20 million a year. We're not going to ever ship another feature again. It has a staff of, like, 15 people. He's like, we're not moving that to the cloud. And so that's sort of part of the heterogeneity. It's like we don't want them to super fall behind, and we want them to be in sort of some of the management, some of the tooling, but not going to move that. And this is a good example here where they're not going to, I don't think they have anyone on staff that knows how that code base works anymore. So they're not going to actually like rewrite it or repackage it even to go to any other platform. They're just bleeding it out. And then there's some challenges with heterogeneity, obviously. So there's the issue of management. Management is more difficult than if everything is just the same. If everything's the same, then you all have the same APIs, the same behavior, semantics, and so that becomes easier. And then there's going to be a speed of light concern, not a big deal, with like the way data is stored. You can't just throw compute on one thing and the data on another cloud because there's going to be speed of light issues between them. But there's some solutions to this. So for the management of workloads, there are tools out there. One of ours is Terraform, but another good example that we're not involved with is Kubernetes. These are tools that are completely don't care what the cloud provider is or what the tech stack is or anything. They're completely heterogeneous for supporting these workloads. And so Kubernetes in particular, for example, if you whatever application you write, it separates it from the infrastructure. So you could take that application and fairly easily just move it to another cloud provider. It's sort of, I think right now, a cloud provider's worst nightmare happening, unloading. And then for speed of light issues, I usually just see people running different applications on different cloud providers. It's usually not like the data for one is on one cloud provider and the compute is on another. It's the more reality is that your business has dozens, hundreds, thousands of applications. They all don't need to talk to each other. They all don't share data. So you just sort of put them wherever they're going to land. Okay, moving on. Less controversial, probably, is data center as computer is sort of the next trend that's coming up. And the idea here is to view your data center as a single shared resource rather than a collection of devices. And so rather than saying we have 1,000 servers with this much sort of capacity, you just sort of view your data center as having a cumulative capacity of this much RAM, this much compute, this many IOPS, and that sort of thing. That abstraction obviously in various cases breaks down, but for the vast majority of applications works just fine. So today, the good news is that developers already view your data center as a single entity. They just throw the applications over, and it just happens to go on anywhere. No, that's actually horrible. So today you have a bunch of servers. In a lot of cases, you name them and groom them and form a relationship with them, and you keep them going. And this is sort of the pets versus cattle analogy. And so you're lovingly taking care of all your children. You manually sort of assign applications to each of the server. When a developer gives you something to deploy, you try to look and see, okay, this makes sense to put here for this reason. And you make a conscious decision of where that application is going to go usually. When a server goes down or you add a server, this is usually an event. And this event is usually stressful and has work associated with it. And this is a pretty good test of how far along you are on the sort of data center as computer concept, which is as a test, like if I walked into your data center, physical abstract, whatever, if I walked into your data center and started unplugging servers, would that cause a huge personal crisis to somebody in your company? And for most companies today, and it's totally fine, because this is where we're heading and not necessarily where you need to be today, but for most companies right now, this is like code red disaster scenario happening where there's a rogue person in the data center unplugging things. It's a disaster. It's probably a disaster no matter what, like the fact that it's a rogue person. But realistically, servers coming in and out should not be that stressful, especially towards the future we're heading where there's so many servers that they're just going to fail rather quickly. So the reality of the situation is that the number of servers and apps that we want to deploy are growing at a breakneck pace, and I very consciously use the word breakneck because the sort of demand on just growth of the current applications as well as the amount of things we want to deploy is requiring a lot of agility on the operational side of things. It's forcing people to add compute to deploy just quicker and quicker and quicker. One thing I've heard, which I think is true, is sort of the value per application is going down. Like before, your company used to have the one application. That application generated $100 million a year, and it made sense to hire a huge team of people to make sure that application was up and running and babysat and so on. Now, you know, people will write applications just so that like certain types of emoji show up in your chat room. And like so the value per application is dropping, and so the actual number of people you could scale up isn't linear because you're losing money for every person you're adding to manage sort of the same scale. So each person that, I'll just make up a number, this isn't scientific at all, but like each person that used to be able to manage 50 servers a person now must basically be able to manage 1,000 servers a person. Actually, I think Facebook said something like that. Like that, their goal for their operations team was, I think, 1,000. Well, this is like 5 years ago, probably like 1,000 servers per operator. But to be able to do that obviously requires some help. Like you can't just be babysitting 1,000 servers per person. So again, therefore, there's some choices. One is that growth will slow down. Whether that growth, you know, external growth will slow down, or whether internally you'll write less applications, demand will go down, whatever. That's, I guess, a realistic possibility for your company. The second option is to train and hire and just keep up with this growth, which I claim is not feasible just from a cost perspective. You have to become more efficient. And so if you intend to become more efficient, the third option is to lower the cost and complexity of managing these things. And that idea, one of the ways to do that, one of the ideas is data center as computer. And the term data center as computer is actually more formal than how I'll present it today. The data center as computer, I think it's data center as a computer, was a paper published by Google on how they manage their infrastructure and how they plan to manage their infrastructure. I don't remember what year it was published, but it was a while back, as with most things. But it's finally coming sort of to the mainstream and becoming more easily adoptable. So the idea for data center as computer is to separate the application from the resources it runs on. And I'll give you a concrete example of this. So you have an application, and instead of giving this application to somebody and having them sort of manage it manually. And you attach sort of a requirements document to an application that defines what it needs. And maybe that's RAM, maybe that's CPU, maybe that's disk, but it also includes things like this must be PCI compliant, or this must talk to this database, so the latency should be within this, you know, 99 percentile. There's a variety of kinds of requirements you could do to this. At the most basic form, it's usually like RAM and compute. And you attach this directly to the application. And once it's on the application, they have these servers. And some external system that's automated is choosing where to put those applications. So it's invisible to you that there's four servers there, or 1,000, or whatever. You're just saying, these are the requirements I have. Please place the application. And their response back is either that there are inadequate resources to place the application, in which case you know how to handle that. It's like, you need more RAM, you need more this, or it places it. And it could look like this. And when a server goes down or when something goes wrong, nobody usually gets paged. As long as there's still adequate resources in your data center, the application will just get moved. When a server gets added, as long as it's within sort of the description document, then we'll reshuffle applications to rebalance resource utilization. And this should all just basically be automated. And it can be. Today, it really can be. And one of the things about it is that it allows for choice in lower level components. As with most abstractions, sort of one of the things you lose is control, which is something I talk about, but because of that, like, you don't usually attach, like, this is where the configuration must live. This is the operating system it must run on, unless it really has to run on a specific operating system, basically. This is the kernel version it requires. You sort of, like, remove all these requirements from the application, from the resources it runs on. And because of that, it just gives more choice. And this is what ultimately allows for more easily portable applications. So if you're using a scheduler like Kubernetes, then when you're going between Google and Amazon, or Azure and Amazon, or something, the unit that you buy from them is very different. Like, the number of the amount of RAM, the type of CPU you get, they're different. But it doesn't matter, because those things are separated and the placement will still work. So there are some challenges with this view of the world. Management of this is really complex. It's a complex problem to be able to solve this. And I mean, bin packing in general is NP hard, so like, it's not a perfectly solvable problem either. Not all apps fit this model easily. So usually, and this is probably, again, like the dog flag people, when you approach for this sort of thing, it's like, that's a great idea, but we have this one application that uses a ton of state, and it can't just move around between servers, and you can't just place it anywhere. Like, there's a lot of requirements there that this thing can't solve, which is true. And then the last one is trust. Like, this is a situation where you're voluntarily giving up control, and a huge number of the human population has huge mental issues with giving up control. So this is a scary, scary thing. So there are solutions to this, and the solution to this is schedulers, particularly cluster or application schedulers is what they're called. So schedulers, and examples of this are Kubernetes. We have a scheduler called Nomad. There's also like Mesosphere, or Mesos, I guess, is the actual application. And these schedulers, this is what they do. They place, given a set of requirements, they place that into a pool of resources is the abstract thing that schedulers do. And they are complex. They're not easy. I used to sort of joke as we were writing our scheduler that, like, mentally, I think that there's probably only, like, at the time at least, is like 3 years ago, I was like, I think there's only like 100 people in the world that actually could write a scheduler. Luckily, my co-founder is one of them, since he wrote the scheduler for a couple big companies. Yeah, schedulers are really complicated. They're not easy at all. And if they do something wrong, it means that you probably have downtime. So you want these to be correct. And the good news is that, you know, Kubernetes, Nomad, I mean, it's biased, so I'll just leave that one out. Kubernetes and Mesos, like, they're being developed by well-funded, smart people. So this problem is getting solved, and this is definitely an area where the longer you wait, the better it's going to get. So Kubernetes is probably like a couple years old now. Nomad's just over a year old. Mesos is 5+ years old. And that's good. That they're getting better every year. For state, We're also starting to solve this. So I use the terms here that we use at HashiCorp for our scheduler. I think that other schedulers have different terms. But the core idea that we have is that there's three different types of state. There's ephemeral, sticky, and persistent. Ephemeral is basically that the state doesn't matter. You can move that application anywhere because the state's ephemeral anyway. You don't need to move the state with it. These are the easiest applications to deploy. The next category is sticky. What sticky is saying is that data could move, but it really sucks to move it. Like this is like EBS or something. It's like it's it we could you could reattach an EBS volume somewhere, but there's some costs associated with that. It's a little bit like annoying. It's slow. There's speed of light issues. So what sticky is saying is like please try super hard to just keep the data where it is and move the application to the data unless you absolutely have to. And so this, for Nomad, when you have a sticky volume, what this means is that it would rather evict applications that are not using a sticky volume on the server with the volume and move the thing that needs it to that server rather than move the data. And that's what sticky represents. And this is kind of what you want with more software-defined storage type stuff. But then there's cases where you can't use that kind of storage. Like there's cases. Usually, a good example of this is just your core database. It on a server with SSDs attached to it. They're not network. It's not network attached storage. The storage cannot move. It's not feasible to move the storage because it's ridiculously huge, and it just needs to be there. And so this is persistent storage. This is the idea that the storage can't move, and so hence the application must move to the storage. And so in this case. This sort of scheduler requirement tells the scheduler the thing that requires the storage has priority 100 on this machine. Anything else that's on that machine that doesn't need that server is going to get evicted. Like if anything is marked as can't be evicted, for example, it's just an error. It's just like it'll tell the operator it's like we can't place this because we can't evict anything, and yet we can't put it anywhere else. It's unsolvable. And so that's what persistent storage is. And so this is solvable with schedulers. This is not. State is not something that means that every application must be completely portable. It's not what schedulers are trying to say. So this is an example of how that works. And then the last thing is just or heterogeneity, right? Like you could deploy Kubernetes to AWS on 50 servers, but still have 10 servers, even in the same subnet, that just aren't running Kubernetes, and you're still managing a different way. And that's completely fine too. If you don't trust your scheduler with certain application workloads, you just don't need to put those workloads onto a scheduler. And that's okay because what you've done there is still turn, you turned your 1,000 server data center, if 90% are running a scheduler, you turned your 1,000 server data center into like 101 servers because like 900 of them are a scheduler, so it's data center is computer, so more or less one server, no problem. And then the remaining 100 you're just doing manually. And that's a huge complexity decrease. And so yeah, just do that. And tools like Terraform can manage both schedulers and just old, normal servers. So there are tools that will enable you to do that. All right, moving on to the next thing, which is declarative. The idea with declarative, and I think this is another one of those ones where you could like get in a bar fight over. The idea with declarative is that you want goal-driven tooling where you describe what. And not how. And so today, here's a diagram of a very standard, I would claim beginner level sort of three-ish tier web application. This is, I think it's from Amazon actually, I got this. This is just a really basic, it's hard to read, so it's a really basic like CDN, load balancer, web tier, app tier, data tier, setup. That's all it is, with like highly available stuff in there. It's like if you were deploying WordPress, this is how you would deploy WordPress, right? Like this is really standard stuff. And when you look at this, there's a lot of pieces. So if I gave this diagram to any of you, probably all of you are probably capable. If I gave you this diagram and said, please make this a reality as a test, either this is so familiar to you that you'll just start doing it because you've done it 1,000 times before, or you just start, so that's happening mentally or physically. You just start making a list of steps in your head. It's like, okay, I need to set up the VPC first and the subnets and the routing tables. Once I have all those set up, I can start deploying instances into those, and they need a security group. And you start just like going through this in your head. Which is okay. It's like it shows the level of expertness that you have attained. And you'll see why I don't why that must change sort of going forward. The other thing is that in companies, it's because, you know, this happens, whereas like someone raises their finger and says, "Hey there, I need a web server. I need the web server AMI changed to this. I also need three more, and I also need to change the database maintenance window for some like probably like unknown bad reason." And the operator or the gatekeeper pretty much says like, "Slow down, like whoa, buddy, like that's a lot of changes. Let's slow it down. Let's break it down. Let's do one change at a time. Let's come up with a plan. Let's test that plan. Let's schedule time for all of us to sit next to each other and hold hands while we roll it out." Like this is sort of what goes on. And the problem is that while this is happening, there's just a queue of these finger pointers behind them that want more and more changes. And it just gets backed up. And so this puts the bottleneck onto that gatekeeper type person. And I'll give you sort of a real-world story of that after the reality section. So the reality, to me, is that the change, the to make a change requires a burden of knowledge much too large. To understand the complexities necessary to deploy the infrastructure for a standard, you know, end-tier sort of web application is just too complicated. And it's great for those of us who know how to do it because we get to be those gatekeepers and there's some level of job security associated with that and so on. But the issue is that we're just perpetually the bottleneck. And really we need to enable people that don't have as much, haven't learned as much or shouldn't, what I'm saying is people shouldn't have to learn as much in order to do a job. And that's really these people. Like these people need to become a little more empowered. I'm not saying you give them keys to the kingdom. I'm just saying they need a little bit more capability. And so, therefore, the choices here are basically to hire or train more experts to scale with the demand of the finger pointers. And these people are, they exist. Again, they're relatively expensive. There's a shortage of them. And the knowledge required to deploy these things is only becoming more complex. There was a time in my life where I would have claimed that I knew every single setting and interaction for every single AWS service. That point in my life has long passed. And now I don't really know how almost anything works in AWS, especially because AWS functionality now breaks down by region. Like, some things work in some regions, some don't work in others. Like domains and API endpoints just change by region. It's a lot more complicated. So the expert level stuff is harder. And so the alternate approach is to attempt to enable non-experts through better abstractions. So protect ourselves, protect everybody from shooting themselves in the foot through abstractions and through choices made for them, but also enable them to sort of make change. And one of these higher abstractions is can be declarative. There's multiple ways to get higher level abstractions. One of them is declarative, and that's declarative is something, especially at HashiCorp, we take very seriously as part of almost everything. And so the idea with declarative is that you describe your goal and not the steps to get there, and you trust something else to get there for you. And so with declarative, going back to this diagram, the idea with this is the goal. This is basically completeness. You can't, computers are not super great at like reading images, so more likely you would turn that into some sort of text form, which is infrastructure as code. But more or less, you take what you want, you give it to something, and you tell that thing, just make this a reality for me. You know, you figure out the steps. And so the benefits of this is that you get flexible choices for how. So now one of my favorite examples here is Terraform is our tool for infrastructure as code, declarative infrastructure as code. And one of my favorite examples is somebody adopted Terraform, this is like a couple of years ago now, where they were using Terraform internally actually as a sort of an API as a background job to scale RAM up and down in one of their, they were using a cloud provider that supported changing the RAM. RAM allocation. And when they changed the RAM allocation, what was required though was that they would actually destroy that instance and then recreate a new one. So they had an API for changing the RAM application allocation, but it was really just like destroy the server, create a new server. But they used Terraform to do that because they could describe what they wanted. Terraform handled failure cases, et cetera. But what was neat is that they updated Terraform one day in their QA environment, and they realized that background job suddenly got a lot faster, and they couldn't really explain why. And so they went to look. They couldn't easily quickly explain why. So they went to go investigate why that background job got quicker. It turns out that at some point that cloud provider supported changing the RAM allocation online on a VM. So the API changed to allow that as an online operation. And Terraform as a tool, since you were just describing the end state of what you wanted, said, hey, the most efficient way to do this is just to do this online. So I'm going to do it online now. And they were getting that for free. And they didn't necessarily have to be experts in that provider they were using. They happened to be experts. So they weren't surprised. They sort of knew that feature came out. But they were surprised that Terraform supported it. And that's sort of an example, just a small one, of how the flexible choice for how could be very powerful. You remove the necessity to keep track of every possible way to do something. And that's a really simple example. You're just changing RAM on a server. This becomes super valuable when you have a very complex infrastructure. When your end state is very different from your current state. When you're saying, I want to make all these changes, this dozens of changes, and instead of coming up with the steps to do it, you're just saying, just make these changes for me. It's also easier to educate. So knowing what you want still requires some level of expertness, right? Like you still need to know what exists in the cloud provider to know what you want. You can't get what you want without knowing what's available. However, the education level required to know what exists is usually much easier than knowing how to make those things exist. And this is more or less for me, declarative is also an argument of just simplifying complex tasks through abstraction. And it's sort of like a lot of people today don't know and shouldn't know and don't need to know the intricacies of how sort of operating systems work at a pretty deep level. Like there's I don't know how, I mean, actually in this room probably quite a few, but most like graduates these days aren't writing custom CPU schedulers or at memory allocators or think very deeply about how virtual memory works or page tables or caching and things like that. You just write applications in JavaScript and hope for the best, and that's kind of okay. Like it's kind of horrifying for people who know what's going on, but at the same time it's kind of okay because it doesn't matter for most things. And in that same way, sort of my argument is that declarative is one of the necessary ways. We just need to move the abstraction level upwards. And so the challenge here is obviously trust. Like that's top ever. It matters, and that's the primary issue is you got to trust the system to get you to your end state. There's another lack of control issue that we'll have to work through. And then the last thing is that it's a difficult problem. So the general problem of going from any current state to any target state for some system is obviously much more complex than going from some known state to some known desired, some constrained desired state. But these are what these tools are sort of dealing with. And so there are solutions. Here are examples of things that are declarative. So schedulers. So for example, again, going back to the scheduler, Kubernetes data center as computer thing, you're just for those applications you're deploying, you're describing the resources you require. You're not describing necessarily how to deploy it, how to scale it, and those sorts of things. You're just giving it a document of what you want. I want this application deployed with these resources, with this many at a minimum, and that sort of thing. And the scheduler is making that reality true, no matter your current reality. Like in Nomad, if you deploy an application, you say, I want 5 total instances deployed, and there's 2 already deployed, it'll deploy 3. And if there's 0 deployed, it'll deploy 5. But you didn't tell it non-declaratively that I want to deploy this one here or this one here and this one here to total 5. You just said, I just want 5. I don't care what's currently happening. If there's 7, then shut 2 down. You just make this work. Terraform is built to be a declarative tool. You describe the infrastructure you want across whatever providers, it makes it a reality. But I also wanted to throw in sort of a curveball example here, which is EC2, and specifically the run instances API of EC2. Most of EC2 is very much not declarative at all in any way. But the run instances API is a good example of something that is declarative, which is when you launch something on EC2, you invoke this one API called run instances, and you tell it, I want this AMI, I want this networking attached, I want these disks attached, I want two ephemeral disks of this size, I want one EBS volume attached from here, I want the EBS volume to come from this snapshot. You say what you want, and that API underneath is doing a bunch of fancy, what could be boiled down to ultimately just executing a bunch of other more imperative APIs to set up the hypervisor for your VM allocation, to grab the disks, attach them. All this sort of imperative stuff is happening underneath. And so that API is an example of something you declare what you want, and then it gets you there. It's not a great example because it's not like any current state. It's usually only like the null state of the instance doesn't exist yet. And also every other EC2 API is very much imperative. It's like change this one thing on this disk. Joyent actually has a fully declarative cloud API, which is the most amazing thing ever. The way their API works is that you just give it the definition of the instance you want, no matter what, and it does the transformations there. So it's like if you move from not having a public IP attached to having a public IP attached, in EC2 you actually make like an API call that's like modify instance attribute and change some thing. With Join, it's like here's the new VM document, and it realizes that the diff is that this public IP thing changed and gets you there. It's from someone who consumes a lot of cloud APIs, that was one of the better APIs I've ever implemented. But this is an example of declarative. One of the things that at HashiCorp that I've learned is that I believe that for declarative to be successful, plan has to become sort of a fundamental primitive of declarative systems, and we've adopted that. So Nomad and Terraform, for example, both have a plan feature. And what plan's kind of like no-op. Plan is kind of like, it just says, show me what you're going to do. So don't do it yet because I don't trust you, but show me what you're going to do. And that's what a no-op mode would be. The plan is a superpower no-op mode because what a plan does is allows you to save that and then give it back to the declarative system and say, make this targeted reality. But if the steps differ from this plan, then bail, then error. Don't actually do it anymore because I approved this set of changes to happen, but I don't want you to do anything I'm not expecting. And so a good story sort of around this whole thing put together is one of the earliest adopters of Terraform was Yelp, and they still use Terraform sort of throughout their global infrastructure. And this was still a time where I went into the Yelp offices and sort of went into a conference room with about 20 people, 20 non-HashiCorp people, 20 Yelp people. And this was various people from their infrastructure-related teams, database management people, low-level sort of junior infrastructure engineers. The gatekeepers were there of the infrastructure, and they're fully on AWS. So I went through sort of a slide deck of what Terraform is, and they asked me to come in, and I was talking about it. And they actually ended up adopting Terraform almost instantly, and the main reason was because of this plan gave them the trust to adopt it immediately, but they were running into this issue of the finger pointers and having a minimum set of gatekeepers that they couldn't afford really to hire anymore. And so they had this issue where they just had a ton of people that couldn't make infrastructure change because they had ticket queue that was huge, and they switched to this model with Terraform where anybody is able to propose any target state. They modify the Terraform code themselves. They send now the gatekeepers the plan. And if the plan looks good, then they're approved to run that plan. And so they're still gatekeepers, but their job is so much simpler because their job is no longer to come up with how to make this a reality. It's just, what is your reality? Does this plan look good? Go do it. And they just check it off, and it goes. And so now every sort of team there is able to control their own infrastructure in a very still safe way for them. And so that's an example of sort of declarative. The next thing is app level security. So let's hop into the world of security. So the idea here is that you'll use app level security in addition to network and server level, and security will exist as a core sort of primitive within an application itself. So let's say today, and actually for this section, it's a little bit more like historical. So historically, you would view security like this. It was very much an us versus them sort of scenario. You had the bad people outside. You built a wall. Somebody paid for that wall. And then you would... And yeah, and as long as they stayed over the wall, everything was okay, and you were in your nice, safe space in the middle where obviously no problems could exist because it's all their fault. And so us versus them was the mentality of security at the time. And so historically, the way you would approach this is an external versus internal approach to security. So you would have a firewall, a global internet-level firewall that was extranet, intranet, right? You would control that barrier. You would also have server-to-server sort of firewalls. These are like IP tables or route tables. This is just basic sort of things. These rules were usually pretty hand-curated, so determining what ports were open, what protocols were allowed, that sort of thing was just hand-done, managed. And then, just as an aside, sort of unrelated to the top three bullet points, but there's still a lot of unencrypted internal communication at this point. I mean, everyone did this for a while. So the reality is threefold here. So the first reality is that clouds start to blur this line. It's not us versus them. It seems us versus them, but it's a purely software-defined us versus them. So it's questionable, at least like from a security standpoint. I don't know if you just fully blindly trust that. So clouds blur the line of you can no longer go into a physical building and look at a hole in the wall with a bunch of cable and be like, that is where they're coming in. That's the hole. Like you can't do that anymore. Now it's just this nebulous like bits everywhere. The other thing is that a lot of we've determined that a lot of threats come from within. So whether it's actually a malicious internal employee espionage type scenario, or it's just that somebody plugged in a USB stick while they're on the corporate VPN, like threats come now from within. So we have to protect against that. That's not new. People were, I mean, server to server was sort of like one of, that was something they were protecting against. And then the last thing, which you'll see is a common trend, is just there's just orders of magnitude more applications being deployed. Actually, a quick story here. So one example here was last year we went to London and met with a bank there, and we had their CIO in the room, and we're painting this beautiful, glorious future of what infrastructure will look like. And the CIO started laughing, which is not a good sign. And he started laughing, and he apologized, like, no, this is great, this is beautiful, but it doesn't. He said it doesn't matter if we could deploy in 5 milliseconds, because it takes 3 months to approve a new security rule in our firewall. And I was like, okay, so this is a totally different problem. And what they actually had at the time was they had a huge, commercial, expensive firewall thing, and they had 2 million rules on the firewall of various levels, and the 2 million rules were stored in an Excel spreadsheet. And whenever you wanted to deploy an application, it required changing routing tables and things like that. And that, so you would also do their thing and so on. They would pipeline. People were getting used to, I mean, when there's hardship, you find ways around it. So developers and so on would basically submit the request to open various parts of the firewall while they're still developing, because they knew this took so long. That would go into this committee. The committee would enter it into their Excel spreadsheet. The spreadsheet did a bunch of like crazy things, like relational things. And determined whether if it conflicted with anything else, whether it worked. They also mentally went through, you know, you had the people in the room that just had to have a spidey sense that were like, this rule, I swear we didn't do this for some reason. And you know, you have that thing going on. And eventually, sort of like 3 months later, you got the rule to hopefully be approved, and then the app's already just been deployed and waiting for traffic to be able to ever talk to it, and then you open it and suddenly like everybody's happy. And so that's an issue. And this order of magnitude of apps is one of the things that makes that issue not palatable for them anymore. They're a bank that's moving from hundreds of applications to way more than that, and this is their top concern. So therefore, the choices here are to, one, continue to manually curate the rules all the time. Actually, interestingly, that changes too. But it also means, you know, hire or train more experts that can understand those rules and just try to scale up the flow and try to push that queue faster. Or the other option is to move security to a different layer that, again, is sort of a trend of enabling less expert people. They're probably still security-minded, but enabling less expert people to make more isolated decisions. So stop modifying the 2 million rule global corporate firewall and start breaking that down to a bunch of different firewalls. So Apple Security is three things, basically, three major trends define what this is currently. It's end-to-end encryption for everything, identity attached to all communication, and sort of permission-based APIs, permission-checked APIs. So in a more visual story, we have red and pink or purple here, or blue and pink or purple here. And all communication, as this will be the last time the lock exists, but assume all communication should be encrypted in some way. This is usually TLS, but for it could be other things, I guess. So assume it's encrypted. And the way this would work is basically like blue says to pink, like, hi, I'm Alice. Pink responds, you know, hey there, I'm Bob. There's two of those. Blue then requests, you know, like, I need to bill this user Charles, $34. And then pink responds, like, okay, Charles has been billed. Awesome. There's alternate realities where you say, hi, I'm Alice. And pink responds, like, nope, no, you're not. You're not Alice. And that's an issue. Another alternate reality is that it is Alice. And she says, I need to bill Charles $34. And, oops. And pink responds, you know, like, sorry, Alice, you can't do that. And this is sort of, in a nice little visual story, the idea behind Apple Security is that none of this communication was blocked or checked or anything by any global firewall. These are in the application, being checked by the application and verified there. And so, to reiterate again, all connections have identity associated with them. That's important for various auditing things. All connections are encrypted. This helps protect against internal threats. All requests are checked for permission. The second bullet point in particular is a problem because if you're encrypting all connections end-to-end, then it makes it so that your firewall could probably still do like port stuff, but you can't man in the middle of your own connections anymore, which is what a lot of firewalls do for various things. So that breaks down. And so you need to do these checks sort of in the applications. And this enables sort of efficient growth because what this is trying to do is this doesn't replace, this is the next slide, is important. This doesn't replace the security you already have. Like you still do perimeter security. You still do IP tables and routing table rules. It's just moving the sort of application level logic security to the application. You still have a huge security team. Security matters. You still have a security team. The security team is defining what those low-level rules are. And an example of someone adopting this is, you know, that core security team says, okay, all application traffic must be TLS, and it must flow over this port range. So you'll never open any other port. We're giving you these 1,000 ports for only TLS connections. Here they are. And now that port range, similar to sort of like radio ranges, is like, that's your problem now. Like, just adhere to regulation. And it moves up. And then when it moves, I might have slides for this, I don't know, but when it moves up, basically what that enables is that, like, for that bank example, when they're building an application, you no longer go to the core security team to request access. You go to the other applications you need to talk to and say, like, hey, I'm going to identify as this group or this person or whatever. I want access to these APIs. And there's sort of like higher level security people around the company that make that decision of whether that's allowed or not. And so it sort of splits security up into more focused roles. And so there's challenges with this. One is that TLS in general is just pretty tricky. Identity is also hard. And then modifying apps is probably the hardest thing. Like this idea is requesting that you actually build security into applications, which one, developers are particularly not interested in, and two, there's a lot of legacy out there that you just don't want to touch or aren't ever going to touch. And luckily, like every section here, we have solutions. So this is the only section where I only mention one of our tools, but a security server, quote unquote. We don't market it like that, but for the purpose of like this talk, you could view Vault as that. Having a single point of trust is really useful for this sort of thing. A common saying in security that we align ourselves with is put all your eggs in one basket and put that basket in Fort Knox. And the idea there is, you know, it's better to do security exceptionally well in one location than sort of split it up. And that sounds counterintuitive to what I'm saying here, but it's not, because the security server is your Fort Knox, and in our case, we try to make that Vault. And this is the thing that's actually doing, it's the trusted point set up by the core security team. This is a single trusted entity that's doing all the TLS verification. It's your CA. It's doing all the identity verification, which might also just be TLS. It's doing all the permissions checking. It's kind of like a Kerberos, except not that protocol. And it does a bunch of other things too. But that helps that quite a bit. So Vault in particular, for example, for the TLS problem, is it gives you a JSON over HTTP on TLS, but JSON over HTTP API to manage all your certificates. It is a completely RFC compliant for like three dozen RFCs CA. And it's very much proven in that aspect too. Like the people who developed the CA functionality originally in Vault was Akamai, the giant global CDN. And they use Vault as their only internal CA for almost all their services internally. And so, like, this is a thing that people trust and is used at scale and supports some really weird TLS functionality that didn't know was there. The other issues that it could solve is schedulers could solve is sort of orchestrating the setup. So if you're not going to change your application, you could still limit the scope of where this happens. So schedulers, like, we just tweeted about like a couple weeks ago, like as Kubernetes Vault integration, and Nomad integrates with Vault, can actually, if you trust the scheduler, which security's all turtles and we won't go through all the turtles, but like if you can trust your scheduler, then the scheduler could actually set up like a local man in the middle, like a local endpoint where all connections going out are wrapped in TLS and sent across, and all connections coming in are unwrapped, and do all the checking there. And that allows it so that your application that was never built to have app-level security doesn't need to know about it, and that's okay. So there's various things that options you have. And so one of the last things I talk about is DevOps, and yeah, we'll go into this. So the idea here, though, is basically that DevOps security must more or less be able to work together to try to streamline all this stuff. And so I've covered a lot of like tool techniques, and this is more the only sort of people technique I cover. But real quick, like DevOps, like I don't actually care what this word is. Like you could choose, if you just hate this word or hate this trend or whatever, you could choose to ignore it. What's more important to me than the word is just the idea that we move from this handoff process to these people working together. And all the technologies or the technology trends I showed prior to this are about enabling that sort of parallelism, right? It's about enabling less expert people, because you can't constantly make groups of expert people. It's just not possible. So enabling non-expert people to make a significant change in order to streamline this stuff. So being able to deploy, being able to create infrastructure, secure it, is really important. And realistically, you just have a bunch of this. And they're not necessarily three people, right? These are teams, so it's a bunch of people. Not necessarily every team has security. I'm not trying to tell you what the organizational structure is. I'm just trying to share sort of the abstract idea of these people must be able to work together to make all this work in addition to the technical change that's happening. So yes, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to start like skipping some slides. But I promised a glorious future, so let me paint this glorious future of what this looks like if this works properly. We do have a globally distributed set of available resources that are available on demand when we want them. Utilizing those resources in most cases is pretty much as simple as double click to run. because of schedulers, right? It's just send it, it runs. Spiritually equivalent to just double click to run. You build and deploy most complex things by describing what you want, not describing how to do it. So you're separated from the complexity of knowing how to get things done, and you can move on to other harder, higher level problems. All the applications you deploy are secured by each other, so there's app-to-app security, so that in addition to server and perimeter, but even if you don't have that, you're at least protected to some extent. And because people can work together, sort of deploying dozens or hundreds or thousands of applications is not as stressful as it is today. And one thing to notice is that sort of this glorious future is sort of centered around the idea of high-level workflows rather than actually specific technologies. So I'm not betting in any way that containers are going to be the way, or this language is going to be the way, or whatever. You saw earlier, I claimed that a lot of different things will be the way to do it. But more importantly, like no matter what, this sort of like trend is focused on a higher level thing, because I think that's more important than what's happening underneath. And then really quickly, so I made a lot of I made a lot I talked a lot about a lot of things that are like happening today and pretty well proven. Like these are things that everything I talked about here are things I talk about on a weekly basis with very, very large companies. Like they're happening both at the small hobbyist level and at the enterprise-y level. Like they're not risky. These are real things happening. But I did want to like at least throw something out there that was a little bit risky to talk about, which I don't think is a for sure thing, but is interesting to talk about. So future stuff. I want to mention serverless, just to make sure I piss somebody off at least. So the idea behind serverless, and this is the last section, is that you upload a small unit that manifests sort of the compute to realize its result upon invocation. So that's a lot of words, but basically you upload these small units. They don't necessarily, they're kind of like Schrodinger's units. They don't really exist until you look at them, and when you look at them, they give you the result, but you're not sure if they were actually there or not. and so that's complicated. So visually, okay, so you upload this unit that could bill users. You give it an ID, it bills the user. That in turn also talks to these other units, which is like charge the user some amount, make the receipt for a user. I don't know. This could be a whole tree of various little like units. I'm calling them units. They could be functions. Right now, I guess they're functions, but they're little application units. And a request comes in from the void, and you just don't know if there were like servers there to respond to this thing. But it's always there for you. The idea is that's hopefully always there for you. And then it gives you back a response, and then maybe not, that thing just disappears again. And so that's basically the idea of serverless. And this word is somewhat unfortunate, I guess, and makes a lot of people very upset. So like there's a couple main arguments against just the word, which I'll talk about, which is the first one that's always there is like there's still servers, this whole thing's a lie. You know, the whole idea of serverless is based on like a crumbling foundation. This can't work. And so, sure, but it's like I don't anybody who actually works with serverless, no one's going to complain that there aren't servers. There's like, of course, a lot of servers. There's actually an extremely barely fathomable amount of servers making this work. But the serverless is like, I am serverless. I don't have any servers. You have a ton of servers, but I don't have any, and that's sort of where this unfortunate name comes from. So I don't really like that argument too much. The more reasonable argument is that serverless is just a newfangled PaaS, a newfangled platform as a service. Like Heroku, more or less, was serverless. Like I deployed something, the server or like it didn't really exist till I requested it. It was really slow, and then it responded because it was starting itself up. And that's a lot more reasonable. But to me, what's interesting is the unit of deployment. So serverless is purposely, that movement is purposely trying to constrain the unit of deployment to be much smaller than an entire application. And I think that constraint actually makes it novel. And that constraint actually will probably mean interesting things in the future for how we could build the serverless control planes and that sort of thing. I should go back and say that serverless as a concept is not novel. There's big companies that use serverless in a very, very successful way, but serverless as like as a service like Lambda or just for the masses is pretty novel. So then the last question is basically like, why? Why is this happening? Everything's fine. And there's a couple ideas that maybe I have here. And again, I just want to disclaim again that serverless could totally fail, and I have no bias either way. If it fails, okay. If it succeeds, okay. Like, I don't personally care today in its success or failure. But I still have to look at it because it could potentially affect sort of my business for one, and my board and other executives ask me sort of like, how is this going to affect us? And we have to think about that. But also, like, from a pure technology standpoint, it's interesting. I find new things interesting. So I am taking a look. But why? So one of the arguments is potentially that app dev has always usually been a lot slower than it takes to deploy it. And in this glorious future that I painted out, the deployment side is actually the easy side. You write the application, that takes a long time. The deployment's instant because it's just data center's computer and it goes out there. So now suddenly the developers are the bottleneck and not the operators, and now the developers are looking for ways to become faster. That's one thing. I think the more likely reason is actually microservices. The issue is we're moving to smaller and smaller units of logic per service that we're deploying, and now the overhead surrounding just the core logic is humongous. Like, if you use Ruby on Rails or something for a microservice, the number of lines of code or time spent processing everything other than the core logic of the thing is so much greater. And so we have this motivation to try to limit that overhead in some way. And microservices, in a way, are you could write a function, it does the calculation, and there is kind of no overhead. The overhead's in the runtime, but that's out of your vision. And then the last thing, which I know is not the reason microservices exist, but also help with, is cost. You can now break down cost on a per request basis, basically. I know that's not the reason they were created, but it is a reason for them to potentially succeed. And the last thing is, why not? Like, I always say this. It's like, if you could do it, it's worth trying. It's people will, like, hate you for it, but, like, just giving it a shot isn't necessarily a bad thing because it might turn into something bigger than you imagined. So why not? And there are a bunch of applications. So microservices said, business intelligence is actually the most interesting one for me right now. Like, if I could stop, like, I don't have to deal with this, I guess, on database, but especially my last job, like, if I could stop business people from asking me to somehow extract or compute a certain metric, that would be fantastic. And there's tools to do that, and like various things you could buy to place on top of your data source to allow them to do that. But it is interesting to me to be able to calculate more complex things by writing like simple JavaScript functions. You could teach, just as every business person these days knows SQL, you could teach business people like JavaScript or some basic language to do compute. And also super interesting is batch jobs, just background stuff that has to happen, that happens and then stops. This could be a really easy way to write those. And then the last slide, what does this mean for us, though, is really what's important to me, why I look at it for our business. It's like, what does it mean? In the short term, like, pretty much nothing. There's way too many unknowns still, especially for me. Like, the way HashiCorp makes money is through like global 2,000 companies, and there's so many unknown answers for serverless in terms of just like auditability, ACLs, like how you compose complex applications. There's so many unknowns that it's just unrealistic to be adopted very soon. So it's not a big deal. Also heterogeneity, like I don't think every application is going to fit a serverless model. So I think that everything else will still exist. It's more likely that serverless will augment everything we have for certain micro tasks. And then, of course, at the end, underneath, there's still a ton of servers running this stuff. So in the same way that even with data center as computer, you still need tools to manage the servers that the scheduler is sitting on top of, that's still sort of going to exist. So it doesn't mean much. I wouldn't be afraid of it, but it's still super interesting. And that's it. So, oops, I lost it, but thank you. All right. Thank you. I have 5 minutes for Q&A, and then the rest I'm happy to talk about outside. So if there's any questions, I'll take them.
And please use the microphones.
Oh, I guess there's it's microphones, and you're at one first, so go
sure.
for it.
Do you have any tips on how to explore and vet the different schedulers there are out there?
How to
build that trust?
How to explore the schedulers?
Mm-hmm.
My tips would be to just try them. So, like, there's pretty much only three, right? Or four, maybe, I guess if you count Docker Swarm, but that's really, I mean, Docker Swarm, you could invalidate really quickly if you believe in heterogeneity, because it only schedules Docker containers. So that's up to you. But there's really only Kubernetes, Nomad, Mesos, and Docker Swarm. So there's few enough that you could just try them on your own. There's a ton more schedulers historically, but those are the only real four that are being adopted in this mindset of things.
So to clarify, what I mean is, earlier you alluded to the fact that whether or not you trust your scheduler. So, like, what are some of the questions and the test cases and things to consider?
Yeah, I mean, the hardest thing is probably, I mean, I would just, like, ask bigger users some of them blog about it, but talking to users at conferences that actually use the thing of how it's worked for them. Because every scheduler vendor is going to tell you it works perfectly. So, yeah.
So Nomad? Yeah.
Nomad's great. That's great. All right, any other questions? Cool. Okay. Well, I'll be outside, so thank you very much.